All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Today we're going to continue our survey of the pioneering social slash community websites by sitting down with David Bonnet, who, along with John Reznor, founded GeoCities. David recounts for us how a lifelong passion for communications technology inspired the idea of GeoCities, how and why that site grew to become one of the five most popular web destinations in the world by the late 90s, as well as the company's blockbuster sale to Yahoo. We also marvel at how GeoCities lives on thanks to the passion and affection of the GeoCities community. Towards the end, we also talk a bit about his philanthropy, which, granted, a lot of the people we talk to are engaged in philanthropic efforts, but David is next level. Seriously, the guy is prolific, to say the least. So please enjoy this conversation with the fascinating David Bonnet. David Bonnet, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Happy to be here, Brian. Thank you.
Is it true? You grew up in Chicago, right?
I did, a suburb, western suburb called Hinsdale.
Were you a tech kid? Were you into computers and things like that?
I was always interested in mechanical things. I had a real fascination with, right from the very beginning, Brian, with telephones. I just thought telephones were the coolest thing, and it was the technology of the telephone itself, but it was also the network and the system. And I remember I had a number that would ring the telephone back, and I thought that's just like the coolest thing ever. And I would dial that, and you'd hang up, and the phone would ring back. And growing up, I would go visit the Museum of Science and Industry in downtown Chicago, and the Bell telephone system, Ellen and Bell, had just a fantastic exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry. So it was a very early fascination with telephones. And then I was a ham radio operator. So I learned Morse code and started with my novice ham radio license, then graduated up to my general ham radio license. I built Heathkit ham radios, and I did that in junior high and high school.
So maybe a communications geek, we could say.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when you go to University of Southern California, what's the degree that you're pursuing?
I was interested in pursuing a computer science degree, and USC had an early computer science program, and I was also interested in pursuing a business background. And I get to USC and I start to take computer science courses, and at that point, you had to get a math degree to get a computer science degree, because it was mostly about the theory of hardware and computer theory versus what I was really interested in was the application side, business applications or consumer applications. So I did take a number of programming courses and did a lot of mainframe work with punch cards, and that ended up having a kind of a minor in computer science and a degree in business.
You got the MBA from University of Michigan, and you start off with Arthur Andersen, is that right?
I started off with Andersen Consulting out of graduate school, which actually ended up becoming Accenture, but at the time I started was called Andersen Consulting. It was an arm of Arthur Andersen Company. And I started right out doing application design and programming for business information systems. I would help design general ledger system for the HP 3000. So I was doing a combination of systems analysis, design, coding, just the stuff I love to do. I did inventory systems, and it was a great time to learn structured program development and actually hands-on coding at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And that leads to a couple different jobs with various software companies in the 80s.
A friend of mine had started a software company here in Southern California called Essential Software. It was mainframe system automation products, report distribution, online report viewing. And I had a variety of jobs at that company. It was a small software company. I managed the development group. I was a CFO at some point, and then I was head of product marketing and product management, and that company was Essential Software was acquired by Goal Systems in Columbus, and Goal Systems was then acquired by Legent Corporation, and I had a series of jobs throughout those acquisitions, but the most important was product manager, which was really instrumental and very helpful for my future career.
Because it taught you how to develop products and bring them through their life cycle and bring them to market, that sort of thing?
Exactly. And having had such extensive experience with all facets of the products, the product manager position, if it's a good one, is like the best overview of what the product is all about, because you interface with the development group, you interface with the sales team, you look at what the competition is doing, you're responsible for promoting and pricing the product, developing and determining what features go in new releases. So it was a great way to see the entire life cycle, all the different phases and stages of the product from being developed to being sold.
Now, I had read, this might be too cute a story, but I had read that you first learned of the web, in a magazine article on a plane, but I also get the sense that maybe before that you might have been active on, early online services and message boards and things like that.
Yeah, that's right, Brian. I did read about the web on a PC Magazine article on an airplane, but really going back to my ham radio days, I was always fascinated about and in my interest in telephones, fascinated with technology that helps people communicate with each other, and so when PCs came out, that was great, but then when Hayes modems came out, when the first 300 baud modem came out, and you could actually connect the computer to a phone line and talk to the outside world, that's when everything, really changed for me. And you would dial up to BBS's proprietary bulletin board systems, and then there was CompuServe and Prodigy, and then there was AOL after that. And that was just fascinating to me. It was opened up a whole new world of finding people, communicating with people of similar interests, no matter where they were.
So is it this background as being a communications geek that you see the web and it strikes you, oh, there's something that I can do here. There's something for me here. There's a business here. Is that sort of how the gestation started?
Well, Brian, it was all those except, I had no idea what the business side was going to be. But once I read that article, this was just about the time that, this was 1994, and the web was being opened up for commercial use. I just felt like I had to be a part of it. I just felt like it was something that was had so much potential and was it was so exciting. And I remember having to install the 32-bit extensions on Windows, and I had an ISDN line installed in my apartment and downloaded Mosaic, and it was just like, wow, this is unbelievable. And it, at the time, I thought this has the potential to be a global online service. I had that structure in my mind of, you know, CompuServe and AOL, and I thought this could be the global version of an online service. And I just couldn't sleep. It was so exciting, and I wanted to be a part of it.
So walk me through how this leads to Beverly Hills Internet.
I started using the web, and I thought this has, you know, just this incredible potential. And at some point, every business is going to have a website. It's, you know, I was overwhelmed by the thought of what it could be. So, and I was living in Beverly Hills, and I thought, well, I'll start a company called Beverly Hills Internet. And the first service we offered was website hosting, and I learned HTML, and with a partner, John Reznor, set up a web hosting service for a number of businesses. There were a few banks, there were a few local businesses, and we hosted their very first website. And while we were doing that, I was trying to think of what else could we do that was beyond web hosting. And I had an early fascination with webcams, because when I saw some of the very first webcams, I thought this creates a sense of context that you're in a different place, that you're actually seeing something happening somewhere else. And you know, different than TV, it was just this amazing fascination. And one of the very, very early webcams, I think there's a Wikipedia page about it, is a coffee pot in Cambridge, England.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
engineers had hooked up a very primitive webcam because they didn't want to go to the next floor down or up to see if there was coffee. So they hooked up this webcam and I just thought that's the coolest thing ever. And so I really wanted for us to do our own webcams. And so with John Reznor, who was in the tech side of the business, we bought a couple of SunSpark stations and a couple of camcorders, and we wired the camcorder output to the boards inside the... There's no such thing as a webcam.
Right, right.
And we wired it to the boards inside the Sun, and I had a friend who had a graphic design business in Hollywood at the corner of Hollywood and Vine, and our office was in Beverly Hills, and so we put up two webcams, one pointing to a bus bench on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, and the other pointing to the corner of Hollywood and Vine. And these would refresh every, I think, 6 to 8 seconds, because there wasn't the bandwidth or the technology for live streaming. And then just started to kind of blast out, you know, that we have these webcams. And at that same time, I was thinking, you know, how can we leverage the visibility of this? And I went up to an early internet trade show where Jerry Yang and David Filo were setting up their booth, and I was setting up my booth. And I was on the way back, and I was thinking, you know, how can we leverage this traffic? And I thought, well, let's give away free home pages so that anybody can set up their own free website. And that idea wasn't necessarily unique, but what was unique was the sense of we will have communities of interest where people can set up pages about whatever they like around certain themes, and we would use the locations, we would use real-life locations as themes. And so we had this webcam in Hollywood, and that then people could set up fan pages about celebrities, et cetera, and we had this webcam in Beverly Hills so we could set up about, you know, shopping and high end, and we would name our communities after real places or thematically related real places, like Coliseum for sports and Nashville for country music and Area 51 for science and technology and West Hollywood for lesbian and gay related themes and Wall Street for financial themes. And that was kind of how the pieces came together. It was the webcams, which generated a lot of early traffic. It was giving away the free web pages, but then organizing those into thematic communities of interest. So it wasn't just this hodgepodge. It was, there was a coherence to the sites, and I wrote the HTML for the initial how you set up your web page. And at that point, it was AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy. So we set up different. That was really the only way people could get on the web until the ISPs came along, and got popular. And so we had templates for AOL, Prodigy, and CompuServe users, and I had templates for with certain graphic elements and ways to include pictures. And we set up this context where you'd actually have a neighbor. You would when you signed up for a site at GeoCities, you would go through this sequence where you would pick the thematic neighborhood, and then you'd be shown kind of a 2D representation of a street, and you'd kind of pick your address on the street. Mm-hmm. And so you had a context for setting up your web page that you were part of a neighborhood that had someone on either side of you, and everyone in the neighborhood was interested in similar interests. So that's kind of that's the story of how it got started.
And because I don't think we've mentioned it, the name is GeoCities. It becomes GeoCities because you're extending that geographic metaphor to these sites. And also to be clear, so there were templates, and like it wasn't just hard coding. If I homesteaded a GeoCities site, I didn't have to necessarily hard code the whole thing myself.
No, there was templates where it was an interface through the online services, and you could put in text, you could put in other HTML links, you could include graphics, and you could include photos. And at one point along the way, we would develop our own HTML editors and website builders, and we acquired a couple of early website creation tools, but it started with templates.
For the context of the time, when does it shift into being GeoCities? Is this around 96-ish or so?
No, the company started in 94, and I think GeoCities was really in 95.
Okay.
Some point in 95.
And what was the traction like? How soon was there significant uptake, and all of a sudden, you're seeing thousands and then tens of thousands of people starting to...
I sent an email probably to, maybe I'm going to say 16, 18 people that I knew, and I said, gee, I've launched this service, and you can set up your own free web page. And it just took off from there, and I had a desktop PC, and I had an email client, and every time someone would sign up for a new GeoCities site, I'd get an email, and it would ring, like there'd be a ding. And so I would sit at my desk, and I'd be meeting with somebody or not, and there would be a ding, and then I'd see who that was, and then the ding started becoming faster and faster, and within a matter of months, it was in the thousands, and then months after that, it was in the tens of thousands, and at one point it was, I don't know, 8 per second, I think, 24 hours a day that people were setting up these sites.
Mm-hmm. What about fundraising? Because I believe that you had self-funded the start of the company, but at what point do you have to go talk to VCs and start to really get big?
That's right, Brian. I bootstrapped the company myself and rented office and bought servers. And did not pay myself, nor did John take any kind of salary. And it was the two of us for quite a long time. And I think maybe brought on one or two employees. And I reached out to dozens of VCs and funders, and people just weren't getting it. I mean, the internet was still so new. The business models were completely undeveloped. I remember the very first banner ad was a Volvo, and it was like, wow, there's advertising on the internet. Mm-hmm. Who knew? So the internet for a long time went on without any sense of what the business models would be. There was some hope and expectation that e-commerce would someday take off, and that advertising might someday be significant, but nobody had any sense. But I was put projections together, and I was confident that with a large enough audience that, you know, we would be able to monetize the traffic at some point. But it was so early, and it was really to the point where I just can't keep doing this anymore. No one was funding, and I was seriously running out of money. And a couple of times I met with John, and I just said, we're going to have to, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have to wind this down. And at that point, there was a Northern California VC called CMG, and they saw the potential, good for them, and they put a term sheet, and we raised $2 million. And at that point, we could really then hire people, and we were always struggling to keep up with the demand for the service. We were always struggling to add servers and storage capacity, and I mean, the cloud was decade and a half away, so we had to, you know, build everything ourselves, and so. But then we raised a number of successive rounds of financing after that.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, people always say, you know, how much cheaper it is to do a web startup nowadays. You know, even from 15 years ago when I did my first company, it's infinitely cheaper and easier. But so I'm super curious about, you know, issues of storage, servers, bandwidth, that sort of thing. Were those insane costs that you were always struggling to stay on top of as well?
We were able to. It was a struggle on a number of fronts. It was finding the bandwidth capacity to handle the amount of traffic that we were generating, and we were consistently in the top 10, if not in the top 5, in terms of sites of popularity, and people were uploading pictures and files like crazy and creating sites, and we had a hard time finding ISPs that had the infrastructure to keep up, the bandwidth infrastructure to keep up with the demand. So that was a challenge, and the ISPs initially just didn't believe that we were generating so much traffic, and but we did, and we would tax, you know, certain parts of their network. So there was that side of it. There was the financial side to make sure we had the capital for the servers, and then there was the technology side. We had to build so much of this technology ourselves, and we had rooms and rooms and of racks and servers and storage and disk drives, and it just we would you know, go up to the ISPs, and we just had cage after cage after cage of servers, and we would constantly be adding storage capacity and processing capability, and it was a monumental task. And we gave away websites for free, and it was the users obviously that created the content. So there's a little bit of an aside, which is I was a passionate advocate of the validity of user generated content, that the internet was all about giving people the opportunity to contribute and participate and feel like they were a part of the medium, that it was not a top-down programmed model like radio and television, that it was a bottoms-up user-generated content model. And all of this seems like super obvious now, but at the time, that was, you know, it was just unknown. And part of the challenge in raising capital was, I remember, you know, so many meetings where people would say, why would someone want to look at a page created by someone else? Why would they, you know, want to look at someone's page about golf or about horticulture or about finance as opposed to, you know, a professional, you know, editorial? And I said, because that's what people want to do. They want to share their knowledge with other people, and they want to connect with them. And so, but it was many, 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 many people remained unconvinced on that score. But I was a passionate advocate of the integrity and the validity of user-generated content. And so in order to acquire all this content, we gave away the sites for free. So that gets back to my other point, which is about performance and bandwidth and response time. And there was a scene in the movie The Social Network where one of the founders from Facebook was at the Facebook was going like crazy, and he was on a mobile phone at the swimming pool, and there was system problems, and it was down, and he just went nuts because people couldn't get to this, you know, get to their Facebook sites. And that was my main, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week. The site was fast, the site was easy to use, it was always available, and people would say, well, you know, you're giving this stuff away for free. Why do you care so much about performance and response time? I said, because, you know, it's because we're giving it away for free. It's the users are the ones that are creating the valuable content that's creating all the traffic. And unless it's easy and fast, they're going to go somewhere else. They're not going to create the content. So long way around by saying just such an advocate for user-generated content and the fact that we had to have, we had to have response times as if people were paying a lot of money, not just because they weren't paying any money. And that leads to, you know, a lot of debates at the board level and with investors. Well, what if we just charge $1 a month? You know, you have millions of users. What if we just charge 50 cents? And I had to push back, you know, every step of the way. I said, no, it's not what this is about. This is about kind of an open source community where everybody can participate no matter what.
Well, so because you don't want to go the subscription route, the business model you settle on eventually is advertising, right?
Advertising and e-commerce. It was prescient. It was the fact that these neighborhoods have targeted demographics that are attractive to advertisers. That's what advertisers want is a captive audience that they know, you know, shares an interest in their product. So, I mean, there were no ad servers. We had to build our own ad servers. There were no ad networks. We had to do all that. We had to build an ad force. There were no ad sales, you know, agencies, and we built an ad sales force and called on agencies in New York and Los Angeles and landed, you know, quite a number of early accounts, and then e-commerce. And so we would, again, we would do deals with sports companies, and we had subscription deals for media, and that was the promise of what ended up being, you know, the business models for social networks today, and how they make money, and that's what we started way back when.
I think it's there's a key point to stress here, which is because you had the foresight to section these off into sections based on interests and community, and that made it easier to sell targeted direct advertising based on interests and things like that.
Yeah, that was the whole key in it, and it was successful. I mean, it was the very early version of what, you know, has become today a combination of social networks and others.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that again before we end. But so, within a couple years, you've got tens of millions of users. I think by the time of maybe the IPO, you're approaching like 38 million users, and GeoCities is regularly in the top five, at least in terms of the most trafficked websites by like 1997, 1998.
Right.
You've already addressed this to a certain extent, but was there ever a concern that you would not be able to scale, you know? 38 million sounds like a large number until you realize that, you know, Facebook today has, you know, 1.4 billion. Was there a concern that the growth would just spiral out of your control at some point?
Well, you mean the growth would scale. Would we not be able to handle the scale?
Yes.
I was never concerned about that. I was mostly concerned with like companies, you know, at that stage, making sure we had the right talent and we could keep up and find enough engineers to really help scale the company. That was my and the leadership and the management and all that. That was my biggest concern. I didn't have any concern about scaling the business side. It was more the people side of it, building the company.
Was that some of the motivation as well for the IPO? And the reason I ask that is people have all sorts of different answers to this. Some people are like, well, they reached a point where we just had to IPO because everyone else was. Other people are, we had to arm ourselves because everyone else was arming themselves with tons of money from IPOs and things like that.
We had raised, you know, quite a lot of financing leading up to the IPO. I think Series D or E along the way. And an IPO is just another financing event. It's a public financing event, but the purpose of an IPO is to raise additional funds to fuel the growth of the company. Most people look at an IPO as some big payday, and no, it's just you raise first two. You know, I bootstrap the company myself, so that's a fundraising event. And then we had a series of private rounds. And then an IPO is just a public round. And the purpose, as I say, of an IPO is to inject additional funds for the future growth of the company. And then what happens during an IPO is the stock becomes publicly traded. It's the public that is fueling, you know, the public has bought shares. And theoretically, as it should be, most of that money goes into the company for the future growth. And so, once we had our IPO, I was pleased because we had additional capital that we could then, you know, continue to invest and build the business.
We haven't mentioned competitors in your space yet. There were sites like Tripod and AngelFire, and I think the Globe later in its life started to do personal homepages and things like that.
Right.
Just speak on the competition in your space a little bit. Was it was it you know, a feature race with places like AngelFire and Tripod and things like that?
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, I think that was part of it. It was. I was always concerned that we continue to achieve, you know, critical mass and dominance in the space by adding additional features and making sure that a lot of it had to do with performance and reliability, that we all struggled with some of the same growth challenges, and some companies struggled more than others, and we had an early first mover advantage. I knew Bo Peabody from Tripod and really admired what he did, and the AngelFire people were doing their thing, and you know, competition is a good thing. I think we had a leg up because of first mover, and we had the sense of I hate to use the word community because it gets overused, but we were always so focused on community and thematic coherence that I think that gave us an advantage over the competitors.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, let's do then and talk about the obvious idea that sites like these, sites like GeoCities and other community-based user-generated content sites were sort of laying the groundwork for what we now call social media and social in general. Do you feel like perhaps that maybe you were a few years too early? And literally the main reason I ask that question is because, you know, in 1998 there aren't a lot of digital cameras yet. So you know, by 2004, 2005, when Facebook comes along, people have, you know, digital cameras. They can post up pictures from parties and things like that. And you're still in a dial-up era. You're still in a film camera era. Was it maybe GeoCities was wildly successful, but I'm wondering if maybe the idea wasn't quite mature yet in 1998.
Well, the idea was an extension of there's just a long continuum of kind of this, you know, user-generated content idea in electronic communication, that there was a pretty popular website, a pretty popular site before, it's called The Well, which was a really popular community-based site where people would gather. And then there were as we talked earlier, there were bulletin boards before that. So I don't know if too early is the way to put it. More just that we were of our time.
Right.
You know, we were took advantage and we were pioneers. And I guess the way to put it, maybe too early is appropriate. We were pioneers in certain technology and certain ways that helped build a foundation for what was to come, and I feel very fortunate. I feel very fortunate to have been a part of it at the time that we were.
Yeah, and I think that GeoCities has such an amazing, people have such affection for GeoCities because so many people learned how to live life online,
right.
Learned things like creating a digital identity through GeoCities, through their first GeoCities homepages and things like that.
There's this really great Instagram site called Humans of New York. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And for those that aren't aware, it's extremely popular Instagram site, and he's also done books. And every day, this fellow roams the streets of New York and takes people's pictures and then posts their story. And he does it in just an incredibly engaging way. We're talking about just a person, and so I was sitting outside the Apple Store a couple of years ago at 59th and 5th. It was one of those balmy New York. It was probably like 10:30 at night, and I was on my phone, just sitting in the plaza at the GM building, and this fella comes up to me, and I'm just sitting there by myself, and he says, "Can I take your picture?" And I said, "Sure." And so he took my picture, and then he said, "What's your proudest moment?" And just like that, took my picture and said, "What's your proudest moment?" And I guess my proudest, moment, at least from a personal achievement business standpoint, was having founded a website called GeoCities and built it up and then went public in 1998, just down on NASDAQ. And so he then put that up on Humans of New York, and he credits GeoCities as getting him, as his start and his inspiration for ultimately what became Humans of New York, because his first website, his first experience online was creating a website on GeoCities. And so, to your point, that's just tremendously gratifying. To know that, you help play a part in something that has now bloomed into, hundreds of millions of flowers, so to speak.
Well, and I wonder, again, speaking to the esteem and the love that people have for GeoCities, we haven't mentioned that, GeoCities gets bought by Yahoo. We'll get to that in a second, but after Yahoo shuts GeoCities down, there's been this tremendous grassroots movement to preserve GeoCities. I assume you're aware of that.
Yes. I can talk about that, or I can talk about the acquisition. Which one?
Well, let's do the acquisition first, then, since we'd be putting the cart before the horse. So, how does Yahoo approach you, and how does that sort of deal start to come together?
We had raised money from I had mentioned CMG early on, and they then became very big backers of Lycos, which was a very successful and popular search engine at the time. And we'd also raised money from SoftBank, which was a big backer of Yahoo. So we had investors who were both very invested in search engines at the time, Yahoo and Lycos, and they were very popular in competing search engines. This was way before Google. And when it same time that it was an opportunity for us to go public, both those companies were very supportive, and we went public in 98, late 98, and I thought, well, once we're public, we are, you know, we're destined pretty much to remain an independent company for a while. And I had stepped down as CEO. I was founder and CEO, and I had stepped down about 6 to 9 months before the IPO, because as we've talked about, my background was in software and tech, and mm-hmm. our business model was really media mm-hmm. ad supported. And so we were very, very fortunate, and I did this more than willingly. I thought it was really important. We were very fortunate to attract a very experienced senior publishing executive, Tom Evans, who came from U.S. News and World Report. He was the publisher of that magazine. He had extensive background and credibility with ad agencies and publishers. So Tom took a big, great leap of faith, good for him, came on board as CEO, and he actually took us through the roadshow and the public offering, and I remained chairman of the company. And it's a good example of the importance of founder, you know, kind of recognizing and realizing when it's time to kind of take a different role. And there's other stories for other days about what happens when that doesn't happen.
Right.
And so the company went public in 98. I had a sense we would remain independent. And then in early 99, it was a very, you know, very frothy time. And both Lycos and Yahoo were interested in acquiring the company, and Yahoo ultimately did acquire the company. And I was thrilled for any number of reasons. I highly, highly respected Yahoo. And as I say, I was up at a trade show in 94 when they were just getting started and setting up their own booth. And it was a very, very lucrative, remunerative financial transaction, which I'm very grateful for the investors and the employees. And what then happened was a you know, very significant, serious attempt by Yahoo to leverage and take advantage of the traffic and the service. But what happens is it's very common that there's other companies that then start up whose sole focus is this business model. So there was, you know, MySpace that came along, there was Friendster, and when companies start up and they're laser focused in a certain area, they can outrun the giants. And that's really what happened. Is Yahoo had a very, very diverse, you know, set of applications and business model, and unable to really invest enough to keep up with what innovative startups can do. And so 10 years later, GeoCities was shut down.
And are you surprised that such an effort has been made to preserve digital history? I mean, literally digital history that existed on GeoCities pages.
I have to say I am a little bit surprised. I've moved on after the sale of the company and have started my own venture capital fund focusing on early stage tech startups, and I have been doing that for the last 15 or so years, and have been very happy to stay active in the field. And I thought, GeoCities was a certain period of my career, and now I'm focusing on other philanthropic and business endeavors. And I am kind of surprised. Didn't really expect, and I have been now, you know, supportive and close with a digital artist that has recreated the archive and a project called Deleted Cities, and that's been on display at art museums around the world, and that's just one of several initiatives to you know, mine this fascinating digital archive.
Baroda Ventures is your capital firm, correct?
Correct.
And I have to, so that's what you've been doing subsequently, but I also have to really tip my hat to you of, you know, the 50-odd people that we've interviewed so far. You really are one of the most active and, like, really, really committed philanthropists that I've, you know, been lucky enough to speak to. You know, the list is so long, but maybe just... Tell me about the David Bonnet Foundation and what the role is for that foundation.
The philanthropy in the foundation is focused on the mission is to improve society through social activism, and we have just a handful of key program areas that are significant and most important to us, and they include such things as voter participation, voter registration initiatives, socially responsible mass transit policy and mass transit initiatives, including bike lanes and bike sharing, gun regulation, gun safety, anti-gun violence programs, social service programs, particularly in the lesbian and gay area, focused on marriage equality and access to technology. And this is all pretty much, this is all an extension of a lot of the things we've been talking about, which is giving people an opportunity to have a fair shake in society. I mean, GeoCities was giving people an opportunity to contribute and participate on the internet and connect with others and feel empowered. And the foundation does the same thing in terms of helping, you know, underserved and underprivileged, and tackling some of these major, you know, initiatives that are so important in my mind to, you know, a fair society.
I have to ask, because you're someone that's been so prominent in LGBT activism and philanthropy. You know, we talk all the time about how fast the tech world moves, but I'm wondering, have you been amazed at how quickly LGBT has evolved, and the rights, and like even from 10 years ago? Like, I feel like I wouldn't have imagined that we'd be where the battle's not won yet, but I wouldn't imagine we would be where we are now, even 10 years ago.
I have to say that I kind of saw this coming, and my activism dates back to my days in graduate school at the University of Michigan in 1978 to 1980, mm-hmm. when I worked in a campus-sponsored lesbian and gay student union, and it was a counseling center, and we did seminars, et cetera. And then in the early 80s, when I was building my career in L.A. and in the software business, I was a co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Mm-hmm. And GLAAD is focused on the positive and balanced portrayals of lesbians and gays in the media. And I would start to write letters in the early 80s to producers and television networks and movie companies that were portraying very negative stereotypes of lesbians and gay men, and that was pretty common at the time. And so I thought, if we can win over the media, if we can promote the positive portrayal of lesbians and gays in the media, that we're gonna prevail. And so and that's going to help facilitate others in their own coming out process. So it was, the most powerful thing that anybody can do is not give money. It's to stand up for who they are, particularly if you're a lesbian or gay. So coming out is the most basic thing, you know, the most powerful form of activism there is. In order for people to come out, they have to feel comfortable that there are other people like them out there, and to feel that there are other people like them out there, they have to see them on TV, in the movies. So it took a while, but if you go from 1985 to 2015, that's 30 years. And so, you know, once things really started to accelerate, you know, we're almost there.
There's a sense of maybe the snowball gathering mass.
Yeah.
One other thing before we wrap up. I wondered, because I've spoken to a lot of people, I'm New York based, so when I talk to New York based tech people, we talk a lot about Silicon Alley and New York as a tech scene. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about Los Angeles as a tech hub, either back in the 90s or maybe more interestingly today.
Well, it was, you know, it was very sparse when I first started. I mean, Northern California and Silicon Valley was hot, you know, with all the new internet and tech startups, and in 1994 there was like nobody here. And so that's one of the reasons it made it hard to raise money. But I always felt very, very fortunate to be out of that frothy Silicon Valley environment and to be able to build GeoCities, you know, kind of on my own down here in Southern California. And we helped, you know, we were part of the tech scene early on. And now, just to use the term snowball, there's a tremendous amount of infrastructure here now, and big companies and small companies. There's a whole ecosystem that didn't exist, and so you have spinoffs now from, you know, Snapchat, and spinoffs from GeoCities and others. So the just in the last 4 or 5 years, this whole Los Angeles, Southern California, you know, tech environment has become huge.
So final question, because, you know, it's 20 years on now from when you started GeoCities, and now that it seems like, you know, social is the fabric that really connects, you know, all of technology almost as much as electricity does, looking back on it with the lens of 20 years, this idea that you had even as a kid of like the fascination of people communicating with each other and being a communications geek, has the technology caught up to what you always imagined it would be, or are we not there yet, or what do you think of this idea of people, you know, connecting online where it is today?
When I was a kid in Hinsdale, I had a little wooden block that I taped to my wrist, and it was a Dick Tracy like wrist radio. Mm-hmm. And now with the Apple Watch, you know, science fiction truly comes true. It's just amazing. So I'm tremendously excited about the technology that's here now and the future technology to come. But what I'm dismayed about is if you look at the 20-year span, what GeoCities was about was sharing knowledge about ideas and knowledge about topics. And we've gotten away from that to just sharing knowledge about ourselves and our faces. And where is the platform for people who really have, I mean, everybody has something to contribute. Everybody has knowledge in certain areas that they're passionate about. And I'm dismayed that that didn't flourish the way, you know, it was flourishing in the GeoCities era. And maybe you have an opinion about that, Brian. I'm not sure.
Well, you're saying that maybe you would want a platform for a more elevated discourse, possibly.
Yeah, an elevated makes it sound more sophisticated than it needs. It's more of a platform for people who connect with others based upon their love of certain subject matter, you know, and Wikipedia is kind of that, but it's, you know, it doesn't have that mass appeal. So if someone is interested, you know, just pick any kind of subject. Someone's interested in golf,
right?
Yeah, there are golf sites, but I'm just, you know, there's so much knowledge, collective knowledge, and I'm not sure that we're crowdfunding is a word that who would have thought of that 20 years ago, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're crowdfunding the human intellectual potential that's out there.
Yeah, I can agree that perhaps the discourse generally is maybe a little selfish. Would that be the word right now?
Right.
Yeah.
Self-centered. Yeah.
Right. Well, I don't know. I mean, this is only the first 20 years of this sort of stuff.
That's right.
So
I'm never an optimist. You're right. That's a good way to end it.
Yeah. Well, David Bonnet, thank you so much for remembering all that. I was a huge GeoCities user, so this is one of my I've been most excited for this interview, and I really think that GeoCities deserves credit for being one of the pioneers of basically what all of technology is today. So thank you for talking about all that.
Well, and thank you, know what you're doing is the embodiment and very consistent with what we've been talking about for the last hour, because you're conducting interviews like this and putting that experience and knowledge out into the world, and that's extremely valuable. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This is an industry that doesn't do well with its history, so we're trying to change that. So
terrific, Brian. Good to talk to you.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.